This message, titled The Call of David from 1 Samuel 16, verses 1 through 13, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com. Well, brothers and sisters, one of the facts that the Bible presents to us to cement into our mind and into our hearts is the greatness of who God is. The Bible tells us in so many ways and in so many times that the greatness of God, the greatness of who He is something that cannot be measured. Of course, perhaps you know some of the poetic language that is used to describe the greatness of God. That He is, as the scriptures tell us, He is the one who is seated above the circle of the earth. That He is the one who stretches the heavens. The Bible tells us, like a curtain, that God names the starry host and He calls them each by their names. All of these things, images and pictures and descriptions to remind us of the simple fact that God is strong in power. He is great in power. And it might be easy when we think about the greatness of God as it is described to us in the Bible, it might be easy to reach the conclusion that because God is so great, He must be unconcerned with the things in our daily lives and in our daily routines. After all, when you think about those here on earth that in an earthly sense bear much greatness and much power, many of them, for lack of better expression, they have bigger fish to fry. The President of the United States does not care what happens in Winchester, Kansas. When you wake up tomorrow morning and you put your feet on the floor, the President of the United States isn't going to care. And we look at those in this world who have power, who have authority, who are great by human measurements, and we understand that because they are great, they have more important things to attend to than to you and I and the things that impact in very minute ways our daily lives. And as I said, it can be very easy to conclude that God must, in that sense, be like man. For better or worse, that God has bigger fish to fry than the things that are going on in our lives. But brothers and sisters, I want to remind you, because the Bible reminds us all the time, that that would be a wrong conclusion. That would be an illogical conclusion, because the actual logic of the greatness of God is that because He is great, God is personally involved in the world. Because He is great, God monitors and causes the changing of times and seasons. Because God is great, He is interested in our daily routines, in what happens to us here and now. Because God is great, the scriptures tell us, therefore He removes kings and He sets kings up. Brothers and sisters, because God is great and over all, He stoops to be involved in all things. And we come tonight, here in 1 Samuel 16, to see what might be called an exercise of God's power and God's greatness. His power and His greatness as it is worked out in time and in history. And maybe it's worth mentioning, in even introducing this to you this evening, that this is one of the richest themes that we get from the inspired histories of the Bible. As we turn to books like 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, sometimes these books can seem a little tedious. Sometimes they can seem a little nuanced and rather disconnected from our lives. But one of the richest themes to be drawn out in all of the inspired histories is simply this, brothers and sisters: God works in time and history. He is God over all, who is directing all things for His glory and for our good. And we see that principle at work here this evening in 1 Samuel 16. We see the greatness of God at work as Saul is rejected as king and as David himself is called. And we are introduced in 1 Samuel 16. We are introduced to David. And so this evening, that's where I want to go. I want to preach this call of David, and I want to do so by considering three things from these first 13 verses. I want to look for some time at Samuel's grief, then we will turn our attention to Jesse's sons, and then finally this evening to God's king. Samuel's grief, Jesse's sons, and God's king. So let me begin this evening as we come to this history with Samuel's grief. Now please look with me here at the first verse of chapter 16. Here we read, "The Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel?'" And so we need to pause there this evening. We need to pause there because what is being expressed here in this first verse is not a useless detail. And we need to ask the question, why is Samuel grieving? And of course, we have it expressed very clearly in verse 1. God says, "How long will you grieve over Saul?" Samuel the prophet is grieving over Saul. And the question is, why? Why does Samuel mourn over Saul? And I want to spend a few minutes this evening rehearsing really the history of Saul, which helps us to understand why Samuel at this point in time and history is filled with grief and mourning. I wonder this evening if you remember the history of Saul. Without going into all of the details, but to hopefully simply refreshing your memories, in the earlier part of 1 Samuel, the people of Israel begin to cry out for a king. They want a king. They desire an earthly king. And of course, that sometimes perplexes us, and we wonder, well, was there something sinful in Israel's wanting of a king? Well, brothers and sisters, at face value, the desire for a king was not something that was inherently sinful and wrong. In fact, as we see the plan of God unfolded in the scriptures, as we understand the way in which God is ordering history, we know from the Bible that God had the intent and the purpose to establish a royal line. God, in the unfolding of his redemptive mercies, had a plan to establish a kingship in Israel. And so at face value, it is not wrong for Israel to desire a king. But if you remember this inspired history, you remember that while that is true at face value, Israel's desire for a king was sinfully motivated. Perhaps you remember the way in which God himself expresses this to Samuel. He tells the prophet in the earlier part of 1 Samuel, he says, "Samuel, the people have not rejected you, they have rejected me." Israel wanted a king in a way of rejecting Yahweh. Israel's desire for a king was motivated by a rejection of God's kingship over them. And so God gives them a king. And the king that God gives them is this man that we are probably somewhat familiar with this evening. He gives to them Saul. Now, what do we know about Saul? Well, there's some brief biographical notes about Saul, in particular in 1 Samuel 9. And what we know about Saul is this. He is handsome. He is young. He is wealthy, and he is strong. That's the picture, that's the biographical portrait that is painted for us of this man, this king, this one who will become king in Israel. Saul, he is handsome, he is young, he is wealthy, and he is strong. But by all appearances, by all measures and all standards, as Saul is introduced to us in the history, in one sense, he is everything that an earthly king should be. He is the kind of person that naturally you look at him and you look at his strength and his wealth, you look at his stature, and you say, there is a man who is fit to be king in Israel. And as Saul enters the scene, as Saul comes into his kingship, he enters, you might say, with incredibly high expectations. Saul enters into that kingship with tremendous potential for what he might be. But the tragedy of Saul is how far he felt short of what he could have been. And what we find, if we were to take time to read the inspired history, is that Saul, at the end of the day, didn't measure up. Why? Because, brothers and sisters, Saul had a divided heart. His heart was divided between God and between the world. Or to express it this way this evening, what we find in the history of Saul is that he is willing to serve Jehovah in as much and only so far as Jehovah will serve him. He is only interested in serving God in as much as God will serve his earthly interests. And that is something, friends, that is worthy of us to pause upon, to think about, to see not as an imitation, but as an anti-example of what we should not be. Because the tragedy is, in many ways, that Saul is a perfect mirror of so many people. They are interested in God only as much as God serves their purposes. They are only willing to serve God and to be obedient to God in as much as it is useful to them in their lives and serves them. And that's the tragedy of Saul. And of course, if you remember his history, you remember perhaps in particular the two ways in which this divided heart is seen clearest. In 1 Samuel 13, as Saul is waiting upon Samuel, he's preparing to attack the Philistines, and he wants to encourage the people prior to that attack by means of sacrifice and worship of God. And if you remember in 1 Samuel 13, Samuel himself has promised that he will come. But what does Saul do? Saul grows impatient. Saul grows restless. Saul no longer wants to wait on Samuel. We actually read in 1 Samuel 13 that the people begin to scatter. They begin to go away, and Saul becomes fearful. I'm losing my army, so what will I do? And Saul decides to take the sacrifice into his own hands. And against the divine command of God, he offers sacrifice. And strikingly, we read there in 1 Samuel 13 that immediately after the sacrifice had been offered, who shows up? Samuel does. And Samuel comes and he confronts Saul. And he says, "What is this that you have done? How could you offer that which you have no right to offer?" And you see, the tremendous sin in that is not just some kind of disobedience to God, but it reveals where Saul's heart was. As a fearful king, Saul was terrified of losing his armies, and in losing his armies, to lose the battle. And so he does that which he is unauthorized to do. He uses God, he uses the sacrifice as some kind of magic formula to rally his troops. And we see there the divided heart of Saul. And if you remember, as Samuel comes to him, In that moment, he arrives and he says to Saul, "Your kingdom will not continue." Why? Because Saul has used God. The second scene of Saul's life, so pivotal to demonstrate his divided heart, was 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15, where perhaps you remember again to rehearse a bit of the history. He's going to fight the Amalekites, and God tells him in a very clear command that you need to devote everything of the Amalekites to destruction. Everything. Inclusive of all things, exclusive of nothing, Saul is to devote all of it to destruction. But what do we read? We read the tragedy of Saul's heart. Saul doesn't devote to destruction everything. Rather, we read in 1 Samuel 15, he devoted everything that was worthless to destruction, but he kept for himself and for his people all of the best things. And again, just this demonstration of a heart that serves God only in as much as it serves his purposes. I will devote everything that is worthless to destruction, but all of that which is good and all of the best things I will reserve for myself. And Samuel comes and he again says, "What have you done?" And do you remember Saul's response? "I feared the people. I feared the people. I feared what they were going to do to me. And so I did what I did." And he throws him under the bus. And Samuel again looks at him in 1 Samuel 15, 28, and he says, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day." And Saul begs Samuel to honor him in the presence of the people. Here, Samuel has just told him, "Your kingdom is gone." And Saul's biggest concern is to look good in the eyes of the people of Israel. And I bring all of this up this evening, brothers and sisters, because this is the tragic history of Saul. Saul is one who would only serve God insofar and in as much as God would serve him. That for all kingly appearances that this man had, his heart was divided. His heart was divided. And now we come to it here in 1 Samuel 16, verse 1. And the Lord puts this question to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul?" Why does the prophet grieve? The prophet grieves because of Saul's sins. Because of the division of Saul's heart, because Saul could not be the one that they trusted in and relied upon to bring the victories that a king is supposed to bring. And Samuel grieves. Samuel grieves the sins of Saul. And it's so important that this verse, that this passage frame for us our introduction to David. Because, brothers and sisters, this is the backdrop of David's entrance. The backdrop of David's entrance into Scripture and into the redemptive plan of God, the backdrop is Saul's tragic history. The backdrop is the grief and the sorrow of sin. The backdrop is the inability of humans and the failure of an earthly king to do what a king is supposed to do. And so Samuel grieves. He grieves over Saul. But let us move secondly this evening to then consider Jesse's sons. Jesse's sons. So as we have it here, in 1 Samuel 16, God puts this question to Samuel. "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel?" And while Samuel is grieving, God is working out his glorious plan. And he tells Samuel there in verse 1, "Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, For I have provided for myself a king among his sons. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. And invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you. Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, do you come peaceably? So as the story unfolds here for us, as this history unfolds for us here, Samuel in his grief is met by God, and God says, Samuel, why do you continue to grieve? And God, in really a reassuring way, tells Samuel, for all intents and purposes, it's okay. I've chosen another, and here's what I want you to do. I want you to go, and he directs him to Bethlehem. Now, many of us, brothers and sisters, probably have fairly nostalgic and romantic understandings of Bethlehem. We probably grew up with some memories of ideas of what Bethlehem was like. But what was Bethlehem? Bethlehem was a dinky town. Bethlehem was a wasteland. Bethlehem, far from our romantic and nostalgic ideals that we often get, Bethlehem was a nowhere place. It was small, it was dinky, it wasn't great, it wasn't powerful, it was not, at this time in history, much of a city of renown. Really, in many ways, actually, we could go back to Ruth chapter 4, where God promises in the marriage of Ruth and Boaz that from Bethlehem will come a blessing. But beyond that, Bethlehem, by all appearances, is a podunk, out-of-the-way place where nothing good could be expected to happen. And God tells Samuel, you're going to go there. You're going to go there, and I have chosen one of Jesse's sons to make king of Israel. And so Samuel the prophet goes. He goes, and perhaps you remember, as it happens, the elders of the city come to Samuel, and they say, do you come peaceably? And in verse 5, and he said, peaceably, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. And you can, if you enter the story, if you enter the history, you can begin to imagine the anticipation of Samuel. Here's Jesse and here's his sons. And they're lined up, and one of these that is lined up in front of me, one of them is God's chosen one to rule and to be king in Israel. One of them. And you can imagine the anticipation that Samuel begins to have. And then what does he do? Well, we read in verse 6, when they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And then in verse 7, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. This is, in some ways, it's such an ironic scene, isn't it? Because as Samuel comes and he sees Jesse's firstborn, Eliab, what does he do? He judges by appearances. It's like Samuel doesn't get it yet. Everybody had judged Saul by his appearances. He was handsome and he was strong and he was wealthy. He stood a head above all other men. And it's like Samuel doesn't get it. And God says, Samuel, you don't understand. Here you look at Eliab. Here you look at the flesh. Here you look at the outward stature of a man. And you determine, right? This is the language of verse 6. Surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And God says, no, Samuel, no, no, 1,000 times no. And God tells Samuel in that 7th verse, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. And then what does God say? God says, brothers and sisters, for the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And here, in such a simple but potent statement, God fixes the great gulf between himself and the children of this earth. God sets a great gulf between the one who is God over all and mortal man. God sets an infinite distance between the creator and the creature. And he says, here's the thing. Here's the difference between God and man. Man judges by outward appearances. Man looks at outward appearances, at the form of someone. But here's the great difference. God doesn't look at outward appearances. God himself says, I look on the heart. God is saying, I see the things that are unseen. You see with your physical eyes, that's not the way that I judge men. You measure men by what they can offer on outward appearances, and God is saying, but I'm so different from you, and I am different in this way. I don't look at appearances, I look at the heart. It's really an abiding principle that is drawn out again and again in the scriptures. This is the God we serve. He's not beholden to outward appearances. How is it that the author of Hebrews puts it in Hebrews chapter 4? In Hebrews chapter 4, verse 13, the author of Hebrews says, nothing is hid from his sight. All things lie exposed and naked before the one who sees and searches all things. And you see, here's the pivotal point here. The pivotal point is that Samuel is looking with human eyes for a human remedy. Saul's sins have caused him grief, and he wants something to overcome the sorrow of sin. And so what does he do? He walks by sight. He measures a man by his appearances, and he says, surely this one will be God's anointed. And God says, Samuel, you still don't get it. I judge the heart. I look at the heart. And friends, if we can just pause there for a moment, there's something tremendously sobering about that. There's something tremendously humbling about that. God is not bamboozled by outward appearances. You know, you've probably known people, I've known people, who put up brilliant fronts. They can bamboozle and trick and fool anyone into believing anything. By outward appearances, they seem to be someone, and the reality is they're not that person that they appear to be, but you and I can't discern it. We can't see it. And what God is saying here is he is saying, I'm not tricked by that. I'm not enamored with outward appearances. I'm not taken up with the strength of the human body. I'm not taken up with the wealth and the riches of this world. I look at the heart. There is no confusing God. There is no fooling God. There is no perplexing God. There is no way that we can pull the wool over his eyes. Here is an abiding principle. God looks at the heart. While Samuel looks at the outward appearance, to human strength and human stature, to human power and human might, God says, no, no, no. It's not the way I work. I don't judge by outward appearances, but I see the heart. I see beyond the skin-deep analysis that you can give to things, and I see what is really there. And so Samuel goes, doesn't he, in these verses. In verse 6, he looks at Eliab and thinks, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Verse 7, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as a man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And then in verse 8, then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Verse 9, then Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Verse 10, and Jesse made 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. He has not chosen these because God doesn't judge by outward appearances. Samuel's looking for a remedy to the sorrow and the destruction of sin, And he's looking only insofar as his eyes allow him to. And God says, that's not the way I work. Well, finally then, this evening, we come to God's King. We come to God's King. I think I've said it before, but how true it is. There are times that I wish I could go back and read some of these histories completely unaware of how they turn out. There are times that I wish I could turn to these pages of the Bible and not know exactly what's going to happen. To read it, as it were, for the first time. Because if we track with what is happening here in the unfolding of this history, in many ways, it's actually quite dramatic. In 1 Kings 13, Samuel comes to Saul when Saul offers that sacrifice. And he tells Saul that the Lord has taken his kingdom from him. And then in 1 Samuel 13, 14, Samuel says to Saul, the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. And then in 1 Samuel 15, as Saul does not devote everything to destruction, and Samuel comes a second time to say, the Lord has torn the kingdom from your hands, Samuel adds this in chapter 15, verse 28, that God has torn the kingdom from your hands, and he has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. He's given it to one who's better than you. And the drama, brothers and sisters, of how this story is building and the anticipation that is coming, the drama, of course, comes to be, who is it? Who is the man that is after God's own heart, the one whom God himself has sought? Who is the one who is the neighbor to Saul, who is better than Saul, who is a man of high quality? Who is the one that the Lord has chosen? And of course, as these sons pass by Samuel, and as Jesse stands there, perhaps himself with bated breath, who's it going to be? And seven of the sons pass by. And of course, the drama is heightened because it's none of them. It's none of them. And so we read in verse 11, then Samuel said to Jesse, are all your sons here? And he said, there remains yet the youngest. But behold, he is keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and get him, for we will not sit down till he comes. And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Such an incredible scene. These seven sons of Jesse, strong in stature and strength and in might. And none of them are the man who is after God's own heart. And Samuel comes to say, are there any more? And it's the least of all the brothers. It's the youngest one. It's interesting, isn't it? He's not even named. Samuel says, Jesse, do you have any more? Well, there's the youngest. It's all that Jesse calls him, the youngest. And we read that they sent for the youngest, and he comes. And even before we are introduced to his name, God tells Samuel, this is the one. This is the one that I have chosen. The youngest of all the brothers, the youngest of all the sons of Jesse, he will be my king. And we read in verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. What makes David great? It's not the strength of arm. What makes David great is not his stature. What makes David great is not his ability on the battlefield. What makes David great is not the strength of arm. What makes him great is he is the chosen one of the Lord, and the Spirit of the Lord rushes upon him. Man judges by appearances. God sees the heart. And it's this one, this young man, who is Saul's neighbor, who is better than him. It's this young man whom the Lord himself has sought out, who is a man after God's own heart. And we have to think this evening, don't we? What makes Saul and David to differ? Why is Saul not a man after God's own heart, but David is? Well, because as we've seen, that for all of Saul's outward appearances, he was a coward. That for all of Saul's outward appearances, he was fearful. That for all of Saul's outward appearances, he was arrogant. His heart betrayed him. His heart was divided. What makes David a man after God's own heart? It is not his appearances. It is that David has an undivided heart. And we are going to see that played out in the life of David. We are going to see played out in chapters to come the courage of David. Not a courage that is born out of the strength or the ability with a sword, but a courage that comes from an awareness of who the Lord of all armies is. We're going to see the way in which David, with undivided heart, leads the people of God, even as Saul shrinks back and refuses to do what a king should do. We are going to see, brothers and sisters, in weeks to come, that David's devoted heart is one of tremendously deep piety, a godliness that would probably make most of us a little uncomfortable if we were to have a conversation with him, a man of profound and deep godliness. We are going to see in weeks to come this man who is after God's own heart. He's not somebody who's perfect, not a chance, but he is someone who is repentant, whose heart is broken at the weight and the reality, not of the sin around him, but the sin inside of him. We are going to see in weeks to come that this man who is after God's own heart is so because he is accepting of God's will. Whether God gives or whether God takes, David lives a life in service to God. We're going to see in weeks to come that David is one who is devoted to honoring God. As much as possible in this human life, David is one who exemplifies what it is to love God with all of our heart and all of our soul and all of our strength. Why is David a man who is after God's own heart? God himself says in Acts 13, verse 22, David is a man after his own heart because David did all of God's will. And in that, God's king, King David, in doing all the will of God, becomes perhaps the most brilliant, shining precursor to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. There is perhaps no person in all the scriptures, no event in all the scriptures, no thing in all of the scriptures that point us so much to Jesus as King David. And here the Lord chooses him. He rejects Saul. He chooses David. He sees the heart. He sees a man who is after his own heart. And he reminds us of that simple principle laid down in the scriptures. It is God who removes kings, and it is he who sets them up. Let's pray.